Hi guys, I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 12th, 2016. I have a home group. It's the Millington Young People's Group. Best home group in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're ever in the area, come check us out. We meet several times a week. I have a sponsor. His name is Anthony, and I sponsor a lot of other people. It's weird. I explicitly remember speaking at this group and how unhinged I was when I actually shared at this group like 7 years ago. And it's interesting because a lot of what I expressed the first time I shared was my drunken log, but I think that really is a disservice to like what God's done for me and the power of helping others and this what you find in this fellowship and how much it's changed me over the years, because the truth of the matter is that I was completely full of crap when I was speaking here, when I had a year and a half sober, when I first really got connected with Dave Palmer. I was promising guys things promised in the big book that I wasn't even sure was coming true in my life. You know, that's just the fact of the matter. I was very skeptical about everything that was going on in this fellowship, what you people were doing, and what was really going on. And I don't think I want to talk about it as much as my first step today. I am going to talk about the first step today. But I really wanted to share kind of what this journey of my relationship with Alcoholics Anonymous has been, just to get in perspective the sort of person who's sitting behind the mic, and he's going to continue to sit behind the mic for the next couple weeks here. Both my parents have been Alcoholics Anonymous, and neither of them really ever stayed sober. And my perception of what it meant to be a sober member of AA meant two things: you abuse benzos and you beat your kids. And if you're doing those two things, you're working a fantastic program for Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I had no idea what was really going on here, but, that's what my impression of being a sober member of AA was. You know, I just saw restless irritability and discontent, you know. Signs of untreated alcoholism, but I thought that was, the most AA had to offer me. And when I finally got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, or at least when I first came into AA in 2015, the truth is that I started going to meetings and groups that were drifted away from the program that the fellowship was named after. And what proceeded to happen for my first 6 months of coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I went to around 600 meetings, and the only thing that treated my alcoholism during that 6 month period of time was the liquor I was drinking before, during, and after the meetings. Because I could not stop. The allergy was on my back. I never had any good experiences going from treatment, from the treatment centers I've been to, so I have to figure out how to white knuckle it. But somebody sat me down and got me through at least a fifth step, then I even set a sobriety date, let alone keep one. You know, and essentially that week of March 12th, you know, that was my sobriety date, and I haven't shaken it since. You know, really despite myself. Because after setting that sobriety date, you know, it was a series of events that, of natural growth of what an alcoholic may find when they get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. There were particular things I had experienced getting sober in the Summit, New Jersey area. Right off the bat, I had been through a fifth step. My first week of sobriety, 2 weeks sober, making amends. I'm 90 days sober. I'm sponsoring guys. Nobody else was talking about the big book and the 12 steps and the meetings I was going to. So, you know, it was easy to pick up sponsees because there's nobody else talking about the things that I was experiencing for the first time in my life. But and the book really talks about this concept of the mental obsession and the mind of the alcoholic being the problem rather than the body. You know, and I think the thing that kills alcoholics more than alcohol itself, or even outside issues like drugs or something like that, is the mind of the alcoholic, particularly this concept of terminal uniqueness, right? You know, I'm different. I can tell you why. I can tell, like, you don't understand. My case is different. You know, I got sober younger than everybody else I went to Alcoholics Anonymous with. I had a lower bottom than most of the people I got in sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I was, like, bench surfing throughout the state of New Jersey when I was drinking. You know, I was mealing drugs throughout the state of New Jersey when I was at my lowest. And I was just a mess, and I felt like I was getting sober with, like, the golf team. You know, and I just felt like, you know, you people can't know me, you know. Look at how I survived up until this point. You people don't. I'm good, you know. You know, and even then, like, I was still doing the things that were outlined in this text. But what ended up catching me is that I joined a group out in Roseau, New Jersey. That was a speaker meeting, and they also had a big book study that I used to meet every week. And I had met the guy that sponsored the guy that started that group. And I was taken through the work, really, by my first real big book sponsor, somebody that really understood what was written in this literature, really believed the black and white part, you know, really believed, like, when they say make amends to them all, they really do mean make amends to them all. But the thing that made him different, which I'm going to teeter-totter back and forth from, is that that sponsor was not only a big book sponsor, that was a he was also a Three Legacy sponsor. And not only did he take me through the 12 steps as outlined in the big book, he also took me through the traditions and concepts. And from my experience, that was the component I was missing from me being a part of you, if that makes any sense. And I honestly think that's like the magic ingredient for a lot of people who get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and get sober and stay sober for a while, but they start resting on their laurels, or they fall backwards, or they relapse and come back, and they're one of those guys, not necessarily even a chronic relapser, but have that point of their sobriety where they get bored, right? Where life gets full and life gets too busy for Alcoholics Anonymous. And the thing that I found to be my relapse prevention diagram is literally the circle and triangle that is described as AA's Three Legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I will literally refer back to that with everything I talk about between the big book, the 12 steps, any of the other AA's legacies, the 12 traditions, the 12 concepts. Because what was explained to me is that the 12 steps, the legacy of recovery, is for the individual, which the 12 traditions are for the AA group, like a group like this, you know, which the 12 concepts are for the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the overarching principles of how Alcoholics Anonymous should be run as a nonprofit organization, you know. And it's from having a sponsor that got me in the literature, all the literature, to be honest with you, like, well beyond even the big book. And, you know, to study what Bill Wilson wrote in his Grapevine articles, to study, like, what AA's message really is, you know, like, by working the 12 steps, getting involved in a group, practicing the 12 traditions in my life, and the 12 concepts of the service work I do outside of a home group. The truth is that I haven't found it necessary to take a drink or any mind or mood altering drug for the last 7 years, and I could say things I never thought I could say growing up, like put happy and sober in the same sentence. You know, the truth is that, like, as far as the depth of what my life has been since I've gotten sober and worked the steps and everything like that, I get the privilege to live a relatively normal life for a 20-some-year-old. That's it. You know, there's been a lot of ups, there's been a lot of downs, it's been some wacky shit along the way, like, let's be real here. It's not perfect, but that's the best part. You know, I get a life. You know, I get to live it, too. You know, and get to rewrite it relative to my age, I get to rewrite it the way I want. But, you know, that could be the same for anybody in this room that's reworking the steps for the first time, too. You know, I thought when I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, especially my first year, that life was going to shield me from reality and life's bullets. But what the truth is that Alcoholics Anonymous dragged me into the mainstream of life. and drag me right back to reality. And a circuit speaker would usually suggest to me, a friend of mine, that I better have a program if I'm going to face reality. And the fact of the matter is that even in my first year of sobriety, like, I went from sponsoring guys, making amends, doing all this stuff in the program of the, you know, in the 12 steps, to living out of my car. And I went from being voluntarily homeless to getting sober, to working a program, to working a pretty good program, to moving into my car and being actually homeless, you know. And the truth is that what I come to find to be the roadmap for, like, a chronic relapse or somebody like me who has a very acute case of alcoholism needs all 36 principles Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer. No, arguably 42, but 36, you know. And it's been placing those principles in my life that, you know, I have an anchor back to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I have a design for living that I'm able to practice under rough goings. And I'm able to live a relatively normal life, and I'm able to go to the most suburban location I'm able to live, you know. And it's interesting because I got sober with this big book sponsor, and I got involved with this group that used to meet in Chatham called the Happy Destiny Group. And at one point, one of the group anniversaries, they had flown out this speaker called, his name was Myers Raymer. And he was one of the guys from the Primary Purpose Group out in Austin or Kerrville. And there's a couple of them out there that it's hard to keep track. And he began his talk that night in 2014 talking about, like, do you think Alcoholics Anonymous is going to be here for, like, 10 years from now? 20 years from now? Like, do you think this fellowship's still going to be here? Like, again, when I got sober and I was getting involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, I got sober in groups that were talking about a fellowship sort of driven message. You know, a message of just don't drink, go to meetings. You know, and again, I have this mind that works like angles. You know, I'm a selfish, self-centered individual. Like, I always try, dude, I'm a salesman. You know, I always try to see where I get my cut. You know, and it's like Nancy Reagan coming up to me and just saying no. And, like, I can't understand because I can't literally stop drinking or drugging left to my own devices. You know, and the truth is that I was literally starving to death with a cookbook in my hand. You know, I was coming to a 12-step program, not working the 12 steps. And, you know, at our last General Service Conference as a fellowship, and this year, one of the agenda items that our delegate brought up to the state was whether that Alcoholics Anonymous should retire a pamphlet called Members IVO. And a Members IVO was a CPC pamphlet that was written by an old-timer back in the 1960s. I mean, this pamphlet was really written when Bill Wilson was alive and was written for people who were non-alcoholic to inform them about what Alcoholics Anonymous is and isn't. And in this pamphlet, this old-timer gives this talk about what he's seeing going on in the 60s, you know, well into the traditions being established and the conference being established and the concepts being established, like Alcoholics Anonymous forming its own personality and image. And he writes in this pamphlet that there's a widely held belief in AA that if a newcomer would simply continue to attend meetings, something will finally rub off on you. And the implication, of course, is that something that which rubs off on you will be the so-called miracle of AA. Now, that there is no doubt in my mind that many people in AA accept this statement quite literally. I observe them over the years. They faithfully attend meetings, faithfully waiting for something to rub off on them. The funny part is that something is rubbing off on them. Death. They sit there week after month after year, while mental, spiritual, and physical rigor mortis slowly sets in. And that's what I was experiencing. Like, what I experienced in 2016 wasn't something that was new to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Is this movement that, you know, didn't start in AA. The truth is, it started when treating alcoholism became profitable. and when insurance companies could really cash in on our urines. And all of a sudden, you know, Bill Wilson dies in the 1970s. There's a big movement to go away from the middle-aged sort of treatment center that you would find in a one that flew over the cuckoo's nest, you know, to like what you see treatment centers becoming today. And back in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, especially when this book was written in the 1930s and 40s, there's a lot of direction in here on like alcoholics, treating alcoholics in early stages of detox, you know, and how to 12-step the newcomer while they're drunk on the bed. You know, but the truth is that it became profitable to go in there and detox and treat alcoholics, and all of a sudden, that mainline connection between Alcoholics Anonymous and the newcomer started to dissipate, right? And all of a sudden, like, these treatment centers started to come in, and treatment centers went from total inpatient detox to rehab to IOP, intensive outpatient, and so on and so forth. And what ended up happening is that message that was being presented through for-profit companies started coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I don't bring this up any particular reason to be malicious either. I don't necessarily disagree with people who got sober that way. I don't disagree with people that tell people that today, even though in my experience I suffered because of that, because I needed to really get into the work. You know, because the truth is that I believe 24 of the 36 principles I'm talking about are getting involved in the fellowship. Like, that was the big piece I was missing when I first got through the big book. Like, I didn't understand. Like, I needed to be a part of this bigger thing here. Like, getting involved in a group, being committed to a group, being of service to a group, being of service to Alcoholics Anonymous. And what my sponsor used to always talk about is this concept of cycles. So my first big book sponsor got sober in Brooklyn, New York, in the Sheepshead Bay group, and he got sober with somebody who was sponsored by one of the first 100 out in New York. And when he got sober in Brooklyn in the 90s, the big book wasn't popular. At that point, you know, no one was talking about big book studies. You had Joe Hawk and Mark Houston coming out once in a while to do some workshops out in like Staten Island and stuff like that, but that was a very new thing. Like, the Atlanta group hadn't been established yet out in Manhattan. And what ended up happening was he got sober in a time where talking about God and the steps and the meaning of Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't necessarily the most popular. But he ended up having an experience in getting sober and watching the fellowship change into what it is today, where, you know, even in northern New Jersey, you can kick a rock and hit a clubhouse in AA. But the truth is that there are more big book studies now than there have ever been at any point in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. Groups like this, you know, but, you know, the truth is that if we're facing any adversities today, it would be really COVID. And kind of what COVID's done to our fellowship and our numbers and the strength of groups and the unity of groups and groups falling apart. And a lot of groups I got sober in like this have already gone by the wayside. You know, just people gave up on it and moved on from it. And my sponsor used to always talk about this concept of how just life is just a series of cycles, man. And, you know, we really in the last 10 years have been in the golden age of talking about spirituality and Alcoholics Anonymous and how to get connected and how to have an experience and helping others. But people come and go, you know, times come and go, meetings come and go, and eventually, you know, life will come back in cycles. And at some point, you know, the question remains with what Myers was saying, you know, at some point, you know, maybe even our lifetime, we may get back to a point where, you know, the message of Alcoholics Anonymous becomes unpopular again. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. You know, and something I was always told when I got sober, like, I was the future of AA. And that's not true. Because the truth is that I've had an experience. I've been sober for a while. You know, the future of Alcoholics Anonymous is in Westfield right now. Getting drunk is a skunk. The future of Alcoholics Anonymous hasn't been born yet. You know, my duty and responsibility today as a sober member of AA is to do my best to keep the doors open for that newcomer to get connected and carry this message to the best of my ability and hopefully get some people excited about it in the process. You know, Hey, unfortunately, I only have a fourth edition of the Big Book, but there's even like signs of it today of where how much our message has changed over years in the Fellowship. Like, it even talks, there's a section of the jacket of even the fourth edition that a couple of them up front that talks about how this book was AA's message. You know, even when you start getting into the fourth to like the first edition and second edition, like you start slowly seeing how, you know, we stop talking about the growing numbers of the Fellowship, and what we're talking about is how diverse the Fellowship has gotten. You know, we're not worried about, you know, getting this message out to that future AA again. You know, we're not doing our best to you know, let people know where we're at. You know, we're more worried about like the wording in the Big Book. You know, you even see with the General Service Conference right now with how, you know, I'm the remote communities chair for the area, for the Area 44 in Northern New Jersey. So, you know, my responsibility is that I have to help bridge the gap between newcomers in Alcoholics Anonymous who cannot traditionally participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. So these are members of AA who are literally blind or deaf. These are members of AA who speak Spanish or any other language but English, who are crippled in some sort of way and are incapable of getting to a meeting, especially if there's a meeting with like a staircase and no elevator. Like, I'm in the front line of getting 12-step calls and trying to help alcoholics with some sort of handy capability preventing them to get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, the Fellowship, the General Service Board, and the trustees are in the process of writing a plain English Big Book. You know, because when you read this book and you study with the sponsor, this is written back in 1939 and hasn't been altered or changed ever since. But there's been motions passed in the General Service Conference that they're now writing a draft for a plain English Big Book to adjust some of the literature and the wording in it to help somebody that could only read at a fifth grade level to understand. And like, I get that. Because the truth is, I don't know if anybody speaks another language here, if anybody like speaks Spanish, but if you think it would be a nightmare to translate an entire book into Spanish, trying to translate a book written in 1939 in Spanish is like a complete nightmare. Like, if you were to translate the Spanish Big Book currently as is into English, it would look completely different due to the fact that a lot of the stuff translated in Spanish in this book doesn't make sense just because of the time. So, like, the whole point of writing a plain English Big Book is meant to make it easier for people to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. But the question still lies, is that tool going to be used for, again, watering down the message, something like Living Sober has, you know, with all the contradictions of what Living Sober is written in Living Sober compared to what's written in the Big Book. But I go to 7:30, right, and then we open up at 7:45. So I just wanted to read a little bit of the first two forwards, at least, to kind of piggyback off the history of what I was talking about in Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you guys want to open up to the beginning of the Big Book, it's after the preface, the foreword to the first edition. So this is the foreword as it appears in the first print in the first edition in 1939. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. For them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication would be necessary. We think that this account of our experiences will everyone to better understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person. And besides, we assure that our way of living has its advantages for all. It is important that we remain anonymous because we are few at present to handle the overwhelming number of personal appeals which may result from this publication. Being mostly business or professional folk, we could not well carry on our occupations in such an event. We would like it understood that alcoholic work be an odd vocation. So a couple things here, just right off the cusp. So, this book was written and designed back in 1939 to be mail ordered, sent throughout the world, really, but throughout the United States for alcoholics to receive for an early sobriety who wanted to work the steps, to read this book and start applying these principles outlined in this book for themselves and work the steps themselves, essentially, to where they could start sponsoring other people in their remote locations. But what ended up happening is once this book was published and was being sent out everywhere, even in 1939, this book was too dense for people to really understand and comprehend it. So what ended up happening is that people would approach the original 100, like Dr. Bob or Bill Wilson or Clarence Snyder, and they would go through the steps with them because it was just kind of mishmashy with how Bill Wilson wrote the work. And in fact, if you study the history, like whether it be Dr. Bob or the Good Old Timers, or read the history, and you study like how this process was supposed to look, especially when you learn about Clarence Snyder. So Clarence Snyder being one of the first 100, technically the alcoholic who started Alcoholics Anonymous, because he started the first official Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, because he was out in, I believe, Cleveland, if not Akron, and he was sponsoring Catholics, and at that time, all they had, Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob had, was the Oxford group. But the problem was is that Clarence Snyder was sponsoring Catholics, and Catholics weren't allowed to attend a Presbyterian-based group like the Oxford group. So Clarence, in the sake of trying to preserve unity with his sponsees, he started a completely new group, and they literally just took the name of this book, The Program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and called the meeting they were meeting at Alcoholics Anonymous. And when Clarence Snyder would take guys through the work, like, he would fly all over the country, and he would just get a hotel, he would meet newcomers, he would meet old-timers, and he would just take them through the first 8 steps in the weekend and set them up on 10, 11, and 12. It was like that, man. Like, that was the way he went, and they did things back then, like, to preserve unity, like, because back in the 1940s, you only were really around major cities to find Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you wanted to go to a meeting, there would only be one available. So to preserve unity and to keep the consistency of the message, like, you weren't even welcome to attend now for original Alcoholics Anonymous meetings unless you had gone through a third step with a group of people. You know, and at that point, you know, they would let you into the group, but like, there's even stories in Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. There's one in particular of when Clarence Snyder was alive, or just before he died in the 70s or 80s, because he'd been sober a really long time. There was an old timer that reached out to him who had like 30 years of sobriety, and he flew down to Fort Lauderdale or whatever part of Florida that Clarence Snyder was in, and he talked about working the 12. He really only worked the Oxford tenants. It's kind of a weird way they used to do it with Clarence, but like, he went through the 12 steps like that in a weekend, and he was on his way. And even my old Big Book sponsor used to talk about, there's a little screenshot that he used to have for him and his sponsees to talk about the recommended pace of the work, the steps in the Big Book. And these are literally the pace that Bill Wilson writes when working the steps in the Big Book. So it goes on to say, next at step 3, going on to step 4, promptly at step 4, we waste no time at step 5, first opportunity at step 5, an hour at step 5, we don't delay at step 9, promptly at 10, at once at 10, immediately, and at once at 10, immediately at step 10, immediately at step 10, quickly at step 10, vigorously at step 10, all throughout the day in step 11. like that. That's the piece that, that Bill Wilson writes out on how to like get through this process. So, you know, the other thing I want to talk about, which again teeter tottering between the steps and traditions with this first, this second paragraph, is the fact that, you know, when the first 100 were meeting, that they were starting to get inquiries, and you know, it was really Bill Wilson in his office doing everything. But what happened is that Bill Wilson in the 1940s described Alcoholics Anonymous as the flying blind period, right? So there is a period of Alcoholics Anonymous where they only had the 12 steps, and that was that. And what he learned is that a lot of people were dying. You know, this was like pre-Jim Crow. This was, you know, pre, you know, 80s LGBTQ movement. Like, there was a lot. This was like people selling memberships to get into Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of really crazy stuff were going on back in the 1940s. And the truth is that people were dying because they weren't being included. And what Bill Wilson realized is that he needed a new set of principles for the group, for the individual AAs to be able to stay within unity. And what he ended up doing was developing the 12 traditions, which were inducted in the first General Service Conference in 1950. But what ended up happening also around that time, around 1955, when the concepts were inducted and Bill Wilson stepped down of being the czar of AA and giving up the fellowship to giving up the upside down triangle of Alcoholics Anonymous and giving Alcoholics Anonymous all the power to the groups, is that intergroup offices and the General Service Office out in New York kept getting these letters from newcomers, and there was an obvious demand to let people know where they are. Like, people always confuse this concept in Tradition 11 when they talk about attraction rather than promotion, right? Like, it's attraction rather than promotion, because it says it in the traditions, right? But what people don't understand, that's our public relations policy. So that's our public relations policy as individuals, right? So that's like me, you, as individuals, posting on our social media site our sobriety coins. Like, that's what it's referring to. That's like going us going on the radio or TV and breaking our anonymity and letting people know we're members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, that's not what they're talking about. What people don't understand is that, like, what happens is, over time, back in the 1950s, that there are so many calls for 12-step work that intergroup offices all over the world and areas started creating committees throughout the country to kind of divvy up their 12-step work to take the pressure off the groups to be able to serve the community. And something that I was told when I first started getting into the service structure is that everybody here has an Ebby. And what I mean by that is that Bill Wilson was first introduced to the Oxford group by Ebby, right? So somehow, some way, each one of us in here were somehow introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, right? At some point, a doctor came in, an AA speaking commitment came into a treatment center, we saw a 1-800 number on a billboard taking a train into Newark Penn Station saying, got a drinking problem, call 1-800, whatever. Like, at some point, a doctor recommended us to come in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, at some point, somewhere, we were introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. But at some point, Alcoholics Anonymous made it possible so that we were introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. So right now, there are committees throughout the country that take the time to talk to professionals and let them know what Alcoholics Anonymous does and doesn't do. It's called the CPC Committee. Right now, there's committees that take commitments in the treatment centers. There's committees that take commitments in the jails and institutions that are state-run facilities that are guarded like jails and prisons. Right now, there's committees that are spending money to get placemat ads of Alcoholics Anonymous, 1-800, you know, you got a drinking problem, 1-800 drinking problem, you know, to let people know where you're at, because you know, again, when it comes to public, our public relations policy as a fellowship, we gotta let know people where we are. Because, like, if we don't let people know where we are, like, how are we ever gonna get that future of Alcoholics Anonymous in here? You know, even with the work I'm doing now with remote communities, I'm dropping off, like, Spanish big books and Braille big books and audio books on cassette to libraries within my district so that those libraries have some sort of diverse piece of literature in there for those select alcoholics who come in there that might need it. Because you never know. Maybe it's one in a million. One in 100 million. But you never know when that's going to make that difference. You know, and even like with the 12-step work that I've had with, you know, it's not even necessarily Spanish-speaking. Like, there's a heavy population of, like strictly Polish-speaking alcoholics that come in Alcoholics Anonymous all the time that can't speak proper English, that need to get connected with Polish intergroup to get some 12-step calls in there and to get them the help. But, you know, when I talk about the 12-step work I've experienced getting sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, well, there's really two types. There's, like, 12-step work, which is, like, sponsor, sponsee, you know, my, like, a sponsee knows I'm sponsoring him. I'm getting 100% of the credit of helping them and, you know, and taking that time with them. But then there's, like, third legacy service work, right? Because the craziest part about joining a committee and the area service structure and doing service work like this, like, or even this thing smaller than that. Let's talk about this group. And the history of this group. This group has been here for at least 10, 15 years at this point. I'm not sure how long it has been exactly. But because these doors have stayed open for 15 years, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of alcoholics who have been helped. Coming to groups like this, getting involved, being able to get a big book for the first time, being able to hear the message for the first time, and being like, wow. And you know what's the craziest part? The guys who started this group will never get credit for it. Maybe Dave, but but no, but seriously, like, there's not a placard here saying, like, Dave Palmer, founder of the group, you gotta worship him out of his footsteps. Like, you know, that's not how we do things in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that that's a real, like, when they use the word advocation, they use the word, like, altruism over and over again, and even the doctor's opinion. You know, that's what that principle of anonymity is really talking about, at least in the 12th tradition, of doing something kind for somebody, trying to help somebody, and never expecting anything in return. So, we're way out of time. Alright, so I'm actually going to get a little bit more into the book now. I just wanted to talk a little bit about... I wanted to talk a little about who your speaker was and get to know, like, the truth about, like, where I've been and what I've done being in AA. But I also wanted to talk about the fellowship a little bit and the fellowship we're a part of. But I also wanted to just talk about the problem in general. And like, really simple stuff. Like, I'm so used to talking in treatment centers, or, like, talking to professionals who are non-alcoholic that don't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, I expect everybody in here to know stuff like, this is called a big book in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? Like, this is AA's message. Like, when they talk about that message and being our primary purpose of carrying the message to the still-suffering alcoholic in the fifth tradition, like, this is AA's message. This is what the 12 steps and the directions in here is what AA believes is its message. Like, that's common base stuff for a group like this. But the truth is like I've picked up sponsees in big book studies. There's one sponsee in particular I've picked up recently. I used to see at a big book study all the time, far away from here. And he was really off the rails. But, like, the group looked at it. I don't know. They kind of like, yeah, you're crazy, right? You know? And he wasn't doing well. And at one point, one of my sponsees picked him up and brought him to my old home group. And I started talking to him because, like, dude, it doesn't look like you're doing well. He's like, and he told me, yeah, because my sponsor just relapsed. And he's being evicted from his house. I'm like, what? You know, and I started talking about, like, all right, well, where have you gone in the step work? It's like, Well, we read the first three chapters in the 12 and 12, and he gave me a Hazleton guide, four-step workbook. And I asked him, like, you were going to a big book meeting, right? Like, you were studying the four steps in the big book. He's like, yeah. And I asked him, like, do you understand the directions of work in the four step are right here in the big book? Like, do you not understand that? It's like, no, I had no idea. But, like, that's just it. Like, sometimes keeping it or breaking it down simply like that is necessary. Like, I hate to bring other fellowships into this, but they literally call their basic text in other fellowships the basic text. Like, I wish we kind of did that, because, like, I think people get lost in, like, the importance of what this book is supposed to be. You know, this is supposed to be a lot like a cookbook. You know, we get, even though there's groups like this that we take time to study what it talks about in this literature, like, we really, we get lost in the fact that this is supposed to be designed for living. These are supposed to be directions we actually apply in our daily life and actually are supposed to go out there and live. You know, but I wanted to kind of just talk, so I want to talk about two more things right now. And I'm going to talk, so if you guys want to turn to the doctor's opinion on in the big book I have, it's XXV. So, I want to talk about two things real quick before I wrap it up for the evening. I want to talk about the problem and what the process is going to look like, and then all of next week I'm going to pretty much talk about steps 2 through 11. So, the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous is obviously Bill Wilson, right? So, Bill Wilson was being treated by a doctor named Dr. Silkworth. So, of course, if you don't already know this, the chapter, The Doctor's Opinion, is written by Dr. Silkworth, and originally he didn't even want to take credit for it being written, but this doctor worked in Mayo Clinic in New York City, one of the top professionally renowned hospitals in the world, and helped thousands and thousands of alcoholics. He himself was not an alcoholic, but he was able to at least study, you know, patterns and consistencies with the alcoholic. So, if you guys want to turn to XXVIII, I just want to read an excerpt from the doctor's opinion. So, on that top paragraph, we believe, as Sil suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol in these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of analogy. That the phenomena of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never drink, never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The message that must be carried to an alcoholic, the message which can interest and hold these alcoholics, people must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. If any feel that psychiatrists directing a hospital for alcoholics may appear somewhat sentimental, let them stand with us while on the firing line, see the tragedies of despairing wives, the little children, let them solving of these problems become a part of their daily work, and even of their sleeping moments, and the most cynical will not wonder that we have accepted and encouraged this movement. We feel, after many years of experiences, that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men as the altruistic movement now growing up among us. So, referring back to the earlier paragraph of Roth, the emotional appeal seldom suffices. I've spent my entire life standing in front of doctors and judges and professional folk of some kind, just asking, like, what's wrong with you? Like why don't you stop drinking? And I always felt like there was this disconnect between me and those people because, like what it's about to go on to say, like, there is this huge thing that was, like, missing between the problem I was experiencing and what they thought the problem was based upon my actions and the things I was doing and the people around me and stuff like that. And the thing that connected the dots for me was actually this paragraph right here. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so exclusive that while we admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems to be the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontent unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which follows by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, the phenomena of craving develops. As they pass through the well-known stages of esprit, emerging remorseful with firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over unless the person can experience entire psychic change with little hope of his recovery. And that was the thing that, like, connected the dots for me when I finally sat down with the big book sponsor. And how, simply put, is that alcohol is not my problem. It's my solution. And the truth is that I have an abnormal reaction to sobriety. You know, I'm not okay left to my own devices being in the right here, right now with no solution. That's just the fact of the matter. You know, that was the thing that never made sense to me when the judges and the doctors would tell me, like, stop drinking, because it was the only thing for a really long time that made me be okay. You know, like, I was a miserable, angry, antisocial drunk when I would drink. But if I stopped drinking, I would be way worse. You know, that was the craziest part. Like, that was the thing I couldn't understand, even coming into Alcoholics Anonymous and people telling me not to drink, because, dude, I see that guy with 30 years, like, you know, you know, you can't smoke around him because he's a little dry. Like, that's what I thought they were telling me to do, was just suffer. Like, I didn't understand, like, what we used to say when I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous is that if you've got a dog and they got a bone in their mouth, you're not going to rip that bone out of their mouth. You got to give them a big juicy steak. You know, you got to give them an alternative. You got to give them a way out, something we can all agree on. You know, and unfortunately, that experience for me has been Alcoholics Anonymous for the last 7 years. You know, to break it down real quick with the first step and to kind of wrap things up, I won't even get into the second part of what I wanted to talk about tonight. So, on page 20, so, context. I'm going to always remember this when reading the big book. So, I'm going to now skip a bunch of pages, but going from this point of the doctor's opinion and this doctor talking about a physical manifestation of an allergy that once an alcoholic starts drinking, he can't stop. And the reason the alcoholic drinks is essentially for the ease and comfort that comes from alcohol. He goes on, Bill Wilson goes on to write his story and then some for the first half with the first part of the first step. And I think it's interesting because Bill Wilson, no matter how Bill Wilson writes out the first step, he never absolutely puts anything in black and white. He leaves a lot of things to be considered and a lot of things to be interpreted, to the point where he talks about this physical manifestation, and instead of talking about examples of alcoholic drinking, he just writes his own story for people to identify with themselves and to see for themselves on what it was like for him when he drank. But on page 22, so now we're into there is a solution, and it's clear that alcoholic drinking is not normal, but there has to be more to it. So this is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic, as a behavior patterns vary, but this description should identify him roughly. Why does he behave like this? If hundreds of experiences have shown him that one drink means another debacle, with all the attendant suffering and humiliation, why is he takes that one drink? Why can't he just stay on the water wagon? What has become of common sense and willpower that he still sometimes displays with respect of other matters? Perhaps there will never be will be a full answer to these questions. Opinions may vary considerably as to why the alcoholic reacts differently from normal people. We are not sure why, once a certain point is reached, little can be done with them. We cannot answer the riddle. We know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol whatever into his system, something happens both bodily and mentally in a sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. So from this point on, Bill Wilson's now going to go away from talking about the physical allergy of the alcoholic to the mental obsession. These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, but thereby sending the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind rather than the body. If you ask him why he started on that last bender, the chances are he will often offer you any one of 100 alibis. Sometimes these excuses have a certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense in the light of the havoc an alcoholic's drinking bout creates. They sound like the philosophy of a man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so he can't feel the ache. If you draw the fallacious reasoning to our attention of the alcoholic, he will laugh it off and become irritated and refuse to talk. Once in a while, he will be left with truth, and the truth, strange to say, is usually just that he has no more idea why he took the first drink than you have. Some drinkers have excuses in which they are satisfied part of time, but in their hearts, they really do not know why they do it. Once this malady has real hold, they are a baffled lot. There is an obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game, but they often suspect they are down for the count. How true this is, few realize. In vague way, their families and friends sense that these drinkers are abnormal, but everybody hopefully awaits the day when the sufferers will rouse themselves from the lethargy and assert himself the well. And pretty much up until the last paragraph, and I even will read this last paragraph of or the first paragraph of We Agnostics. So from page 23, through the entire chapter about more about alcoholism, all the way to page 44, is completely about that mental obsession, which is just the fact is that if alcoholism and alcoholic drinking, if our problem really was our drinking in general, then detoxes and rehabs would have 100% success rate. No. And the fact of the matter is that if alcohol really was our problem, once we're removed from drinking, that should be it. But the fact of the matter is that it's not. We always go back to our drinking. The reason why is that we have this mind of the chronic alcoholic that tells us things that, like, we're different. You know, going back to that stuff I was talking about with, like, terminal uniqueness. You know, I'm different and I can tell you why. You know, tell us things like, it'll be different. You know, just whatever lie, whatever rationalization it takes for people like us to tell ourselves that it'll be different next time. Or just, maybe it won't be. And maybe we just tell ourselves, F it, and we just go for it anyway to blow things up. But to really wrap things up with chapter 4 in the Agnostics, this is just this first paragraph here. In the preceding chapters, you have learned something of alcoholism. We hope we have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. If when you honestly want to, you cannot quit entirely, or if you, when you are drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness, which only spiritual experience will conquer. And next week I'll touch on most of the process. I'm aiming to go through steps 2 through 11 next week and be much more into the book and talking about the spiritual kind of process in general. And then the last week I do plan on just talking about step 12. In fact, I think I'm going to bring either my sponsor or one of my sponsee brothers up from Neptune that week to commentate with me and just talk about our experiences with working with others. But that's all I got this week. Thank you for letting me share, and thank you, Mark, for inviting me.